is us like learning in public and like trying to
literally learning in public.
Yeah.
We were at Vancouver Public Library. Yes. There are glass doors. Yes. We are literally learning in public.
Pulling back the curtain of silence.
And learning what freedom feels like. I'm Nick.
And I'm Lala. This is Seen. Brown-eyed activism.
Healing at the intersections.
There is a distressing and at times disturbing feeling that often sneaks up and overwhelms me. It's an intense energy throughout my core that makes me recoil and think or say the words, I hate myself. It's not true now, not in an overarching or consistent sense, but it was once. I don't know exactly when this message that I hate myself or that I want to die came from, but I can trace this feeling back to early childhood. It's followed me since then and morphed into different forms, growing with each experience of abuse and hardship, and maybe just through its own repetition. But what's changed now, and what's led me to want to dig deeper into what this feeling is and what it means, is that I know that I don't hate myself. I know this because of all of the years of therapy, all of the healing I've done that's allowed me to build a beautiful life and career for myself, that's moved me from a pervasive low self-esteem to a strong sense of self-confidence. There are so many things I do and have done that let me know that I do deeply love and care for myself. So I wanted to dig deeper into what's happening when these feelings of self-hatred come up, why we get stuck in patterns of relating to ourselves in ways that hurt us, and what we can do to support growing our relationships with ourselves in a healthier way. So we just talked about this really briefly just over text when I kind of ran this episode idea by you, and you said you did relate to it. So, you know, last episode we talked about sort of feeling not enough or being hard on ourselves. And I think this could be related, but I think it's more than just the struggle to feel our best or like give ourselves enough credit. It's like a contempt for ourselves or, you know, telling ourselves we deserve to suffer. So yeah, how do you relate to this or how have you experienced it?
So I would say you're totally right. And for me, the difference between this conversation and the conversations that we've been having about not feeling enough is that this conversation of like self-hatred and that contempt that you're speaking to, it feels old, as in it feels like it stems from how I felt in childhood or in experiences that I had as a teenager. I would say, you know, I've talked about it a lot. My upbringing and having been raised very Christian and what that felt like in terms of the not feeling enough, but also what that came down to was like a lot of internalized shame. And yeah, I just like, there's that piece about how I just didn't, I really hated myself. I really truly believed that I was going to hell, like deeply. And I look back at experiences that I had when I was a kid and I'm like, oh, I was really anxious. Like I had a lot of anxiety. I was like, you know, like I wasn't well, but I guess I gave the impression that I was, but I had a lot of self-hatred. And for some of us whose parents come from, you know, my parents are Kenyan and it was really common for a specific phrase to be used by my dad specifically. And I actually don't think he meant it like he believed something was wrong with me, but he would just ask us like when we did something wrong, like, what's the matter with you? That was like a common thing. And I think it became clear to me that was something that stuck with me as I've been going through therapy specifically this year. So.
And how do you feel about that? Even when you just repeated those experiences and how you felt, do you find it activating to talk about, or does it bring up any like feelings in your body?
What's the matter with you doesn't anymore, because I have done I've just like worked on it in therapy, specifically that phrase, which has been really meaningful for me to kind of shift away from seeing myself or criticizing myself with that kind of internal script. The other piece, the first piece, like feeling like I wanted to die, but also feeling scared about wanting, like, about dying. And like, it was just this weird, like, I was like, I'm definitely going to hell, but like, I don't want to go there, but yeah, I think I'm still navigating my way out of that now as I'm trying to reclaim elements of spirituality that are meaningful for me, that might brush up against things that I learned when I was a kid, but are also, some of them are like entirely different. So it is a little bit activating the feeling of hating myself, but the what's the matter with you? I'm like, ain't nothing wrong with me. Like, I know that. Like, I really believe that nothing is the matter with me. And I think it's just because I've done a lot of work on that.
Yeah, it's amazing how, you know, healing really is possible. It's amazing how much of a difference therapy can make, because I worked with the therapist that we've all seen for a really long time, did a lot of EMDR around this particular feeling and thought of hating myself. And I've worked with it with other therapists too, and in other modalities, but that in particular was really transformative for me. And I think that's what moved me from like actually feeling that way to not usually feeling that way, but then having these moments that it just comes up out of nowhere, you know, the feeling and the thought. Do you still struggle? Like, do you still have like moments of sort of a contempt or like overwhelming shame, or, you know, those types of feelings where they kind of come up if you have like maybe a memory or you have an experience where you feel like you maybe messed it up or something?
I think they do come up. I can't say that they don't, but I would say I have kind of learned how to like catch the thought process, like, so like, or disrupt and be like, oh, like, wow, I'm really going in hard on myself. Or like, if I'm stuck in a memory that feels just completely filled with, I don't know, the shame and the feeling like I wanted to disappear that I had when I was young. Mm-hmm. It's like therapy is such a beautiful thing, because the fact that I can do this like in real time, I mean, it has taken a lot of work, and I don't think that I've been able to catch myself every single instance, but I think I'm able to bring myself back to how I see myself now and what I know to be true about myself now.
Is grounding a part of that for you? Like, 'cause I'm thinking for myself when I need to bring myself back into what I know to be true now and like out of, you know, something that's maybe coming from another place in time. The deep breathing is really important, or, you know, taking some like gentle physical movements, or, you know, smelling an essential oil, or, you know, those types of things are really helpful for me to like bring me back into the present. Is that part of it for you? Or like, how do you do that to like bring yourself back to now?
I think because I have like a very, I would say like a wild imagination, I just imagined myself like as, like I literally put myself like, oh, I remember where I was. I remember like being in my bedroom and this is how I felt. And I just like go back to that moment and I'm like, damn, I was really like hurting. And I just see that, you know what I mean? Like, the grounding stuff I think is really helpful, but for me it's just a matter of like imagining that and then looking at that image almost with like the compassion that I have for my younger self now, and be like, damn, like if I could only go back. And so this conversation is so dope, because I'm like, I feel like younger me, if she knew that we were having this conversation, she'd be like, well, damn. Well, she wouldn't have sworn, but she would be like, wow. I felt so hopeless. I really genuinely, when I was a kid, I did not know how to imagine myself at like 20 years old. That sense of self-hatred just cut out my ability to imagine who I could be. I didn't have that sense. Like, some kids would be like, I know when I'm this age, I'm going to do this. I want to like get married when I'm this, I want to do this. I was just kind of like, I hope I make it to college. Like, I hope I make it to university so I get the fuck out of here. Like, I just felt so unhappy that I couldn't imagine anything beyond like the next academic pursuit, because that was a gateway out, if that makes sense.
It totally makes sense. Well, it's such a beautiful self-compassion practice that you have, and I'm really happy that this would, like, be a nice moment for your younger self. I don't know, it almost, like, changes the past in a way, because it changes the story, right? When, like, you realize you've gotten to this place you never thought you could get to. Yep. It can, like, really heal some of that pain and hopelessness that was held by that younger self.
Absolutely. How would you look back at younger you? Like, if you were able to see younger you right now and or imagine her, would she be surprised? Would she be like, dang? Like, how do you think she would perceive this conversation?
Wow, it's so hard for me to imagine because my life and what I do is so completely different than anything I was aware of at that time. So I think she would be really amazed and interested and I hope happy, but just in so many ways, I mean, the emotional side of life was like so not something that I was raised to be in touch with. And so I think it would kind of like blow her mind to like have these types of conversations. Yeah, I think she would like not have much to say because she'd be like trying to process it and be like, what are all these things?
Who is that?
Yeah.
Totally. I love it. That's great. I love it.
Yeah. So I think I'm excited for us to get more into how we work with this because it sounds like you have a lot of resources and things that you've developed, a lot of work that you've done. So I'm really excited to hear from you about your healing process. But just before we get into that, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about the effects that this has had in our lives before we then get into where it's really coming from, what it means, and how we can start to work our way out of it. So I wanted to ask you, you know, when you think back to this self-hatred that was following you for a lot of your childhood and adolescence, maybe even into young adulthood, I'm curious about how it has affected your life. Like, what are the ways that it's caused you suffering, or what are the things that maybe it took from you, or the things that you did or didn't do that really rooted back to this feeling in yourself?
That is, so as you're asking me that question, it's making me feel feelings.
What kind of feeling?
Just maybe a bit of regret for the things that I missed out on, and sadness because, like I said, it's easy for me to imagine what I felt like because this past like season in my life has been so much of like going back to how I felt when I was like writing songs in my bedroom, playing guitar. And I still have like the originals that I wrote, like copyright 2009, copyright, like I would write copyright 2005, like on my little, like the things that I used to write down that I have evidence and like physical proof of, it makes me sad. And I think the effects of that were like, I couldn't imagine, kind of like you were talking about younger you imagining expressing herself in the way that, or being in touch with those emotions. I had that opportunity to be in touch with my emotions insofar as like songwriting and expressing myself through music, but I kept it so protected and secret. And I only exposed that side of me like maybe two times to other people in ways that I felt like were aligned with who I was. And I feel like I wasn't able to be who I was when I was younger. I was so scared of like, well, what if people think I'm some sort of freak? Or like, what if I'm too much? Or like, what if this is just stupid and people are like, what a weirdo? Like, I really wanted to fit in a lot, and I did. And no one could tell that I was struggling with self-confidence. That's the funniest part. It was like I built protective armor around myself, but I couldn't even let my real self like shine through. And then that materialized later on at the end of my teenage years into like my early 20s. There was just a lot of internalized like anti-blackness. And I remember in our first episode where I talked about like having dreams and recurring dreams of like me having like blonde hair and blue eyes and like my reflection and looking for my reflection and stuff like that. When I tell you that I genuinely believed it was possible for my nose to grow like a bridge, like have like a white person's nose is what I used to call it, which it kind of is, but like having like distinctive, like, you know, features that would make me feel more beautiful. I have this like very wide nose. I'm African. Like that is, I love wide noses now, which is so funny. But when I was a kid, I just really hated my nose specifically and my mouth. I was like, it's too big. And so, yeah, it was like I had internalized these things. I couldn't express myself. I couldn't feel pride in who I was in the way that I feel deeply now, which happens over time, you know, like a lot of us reclaim and accept ourselves over time. And that usually doesn't always happen when we're younger. But yeah, I felt like I could only be a part of myself. And that part of myself was always about making sure that I was maintaining a certain image because I was scared of what people were going to say or think or feel, or that I was going to be rejected, really. I felt like that creative part of me, which I'm tapping into now, I felt like I couldn't express that beyond like, oh, I took an English lit class, you know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of lost opportunities and a lot of energy spent on wishing you could be different.
Absolutely.
That you then couldn't spend on just being who you are and developing that.
Yeah. And so I'm curious for you, before you ask me another question, I'm curious for you, how do you feel that self-hatred or that feeling of inadequacy and that you wanted to die? What did that do for you?
Yeah, I was bullied in elementary school, which I think was probably also part of what developed these feelings, but from high school on, I've always had friends, but it's been hard to always receive like the love and care and understand that how people actually feel about me, or being able to like be more open and connected in relationships. I'm getting better. I know I still do that sometimes, like not realizing how important I might be to somebody, and like, you know, what that then means about how I want to show up with them or how I might want to put myself out there. But I remember even in my serving job, which was for most of my 20s, it was years after being friends with some of the people that I worked with before I like really realized that they actually liked me and like wanted to spend time with me and weren't just sort of like being nice, just like to be nice, which is so weird when I realized it. And, you know, I'm sure it's through therapy that I was able to see it in a new way. I was like, that's so weird. Like, why would people, you know, go out of their way to like spend time with me outside of work if they didn't want to be my friend? I remember telling one of my friends this, that I like, it took me a long time to like realize that she actually wanted to be my friend. And she was like, oh, you mean like before we started hanging outside of work? And I'm like, no, I mean like years after. And she's like, what are you talking about? That's so weird.
But this is so relatable. That is so, like, I'm telling you, when this resonates deeply, the kind of disbelief that people like actually like you, like you're like, what, me? And then they keep on proving it to you all the time. And you're like, no. So you got something fucked up, right? But me, still me? Like, I get it.
Thank you. I thought you were just going to be like, that's
no,
weird.
No, I totally get that. I totally 100% get that shit.
And that was actually, I mean, this is part of like the healing power of relationships, that one of the like kind of moments of my self-esteem starting to shift was realizing that like all my favorite people also really loved me, you know, being like all the people, yeah, like all the people that I worked with that I thought were like the best ones, they also like wanted to be my friend. Right. And, you know, like that's continued sort of in social group like you and, you know, some of my newer friends being like, oh, all the people that I'm most drawn to are also drawn yes. to me. And so realizing like...
You're not deluding yourself, basically. It's real.
Yeah. Well, and also like that there isn't something like uniquely... It's so funny because it's sort of like the opposite of egotism as in like thinking you're better than everybody. But it really is sort of like the mirror image of it in that it's like you think you're somehow uniquely worse than everybody else.
Yep. Oh my God. You really reading me right now. Like, it's just so real. I totally feel this. I completely, I've had to have the same scripts myself. I'm like, girl, why do you think your own friends don't like you? You like, I have to shake myself because I don't know. I think part of it for me anyways, it comes back to like that feeling of like, I know that I have like people who want to spend time with me, but like, what if they knew me through and through? And there's still that fear of like pulling back that last curtain and people seeing exactly your, you know, your insecurities and who you are and how you really feel about yourself. And there was always some trepidation around that. And even, and it wasn't that long ago, like you, you know, you were not, you've been in your 30s for but a minute, right? Like you feeling that way of like, oh, this person actually likes me as much as I like them and appreciates me the way that I appreciate them. That was like not too long ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your face.
Yeah. And like, it makes me wonder too, like, I think this still comes up a bit, like not to the same extent, but I do think that I still don't put myself out there as much as I could because I don't think that people like want to hear from me as much as they probably do, or I don't realize how much, you know, messaging someone in the age of COVID, that's all you can do, in a particular way, how much that might mean to them, you know, things like that. And I wonder too, with my career, like what are ways that I'm afraid to fully be who I am or fully put myself out there? I think obviously I've like come a long way to do the things that I do now, but in the journey of just fully accepting myself, you know I'm like still really far off. And so it makes me kind of wonder what are the ways I maybe hold myself back to the world or to people that I work with, without realizing
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm. Hey everyone, it's Nick.
And Lala.
If you've been listening to Scene and you like what you hear,
please share us with your friends.
Subscribe to the podcast.
Follow us on Instagram at Scene the Podcast.
Write a review and just tell us what you think.
And help make this work sustainable by supporting Scene the Podcast on Patreon.
We need our beautiful community and we cannot do this without you.
What I wanted to get into next is digging deeper into what this really is. And so we're talking about it as self-hatred. That's how we've experienced it. We've named shame as being a part of this. And I also think that it's more and that it's deeper. And some of it we've already, again, we've alluded to it. But it was interesting, quite recently, one of the moments where this feeling came up for me, I had kind of the presence of mind to do some somatic work with myself. And so I was like, okay, where am I feeling this in my body? And when I've worked on it in therapy before, it was always like in my chest and like kind of in my shoulders, kind of like a collapsed feeling in my shoulders. So that's where I expected to find it. But when I moved my hands to try to like put it over where I felt energy or sensation, I felt in my chest something, but it wasn't shame. It was grief. And I also felt a lot of energy in my gut, and it was fear. And that was like very new information to me, that like it wasn't actually shame in that moment. I mean, I think there have been a lot of moments where shame is a part of it, but in that moment, it was a really deep fear or terror and a really overwhelming sense of grief. And that really let me know that this is about trauma and the things that have happened in the past. Do you feel like those are parts of the ingredients, you know, to this feeling or mindset of self-hatred is like for you as well, grief and terror as well as shame?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, especially that belief that I was going to go to hell. I was scared. I was such a scared kid. I just kind of always like lived my life assuming my mom would call me I don't know if this is the right way, but her accent make it. She used to call me a worrywart. She'd be like, you're always worrying about everything. Like you need to not worry about stuff. And I really appreciate that she would name that because it made me realize looking back, I'm like, oh, I had a lot of anxiety. I was always really scared about, I just didn't have an optimistic look on life. And it was obviously based in terror. It was so rooted in like knowing that I was never going to be enough. And there would be no way that I was going to pay the price of my sins, like truly, like Christianity. The thing that I think that like I have done a lot of work on, not just suppressing, but working through and being able to name what it was, is like my whole world was the church. My entire identity, everything in relation to how I saw myself, my friends, like my pastimes, like all of those, my community was so rooted in the church. And it wasn't like my family was like super like fundamentalist Christian. It was that like I went to Christian school. My parents were Christians. I went to church. I went to youth group. And so when that was my whole world, I just like couldn't imagine exiting it and being okay. Because I had been taught that like if I was not to believe, then I was going to go to hell. And it was rooted in fear. Like the whole, I have a lot of big feelings and thoughts about how organized religion, especially Christianity, is about controlling people's behavior through fear, because there's always that potential that if you don't toe the line in a particular way, there are consequences. And like that's life, but in life we know that the consequences are like material. When you are a child, you're just subject to your imagination and the good book, as they say, the Bible, about what hell looks like or what it is like. And as I've mentioned, I have a wild imagination. So all those things, I was so fearful. I remember lying down in my bed, and I told Nolan this the other day because we were playing like old music from, you know, teenage years. He started playing Hoobastank, The Reason. And I was like, let me put you onto some shit that I used to listen to when I was a kid. And it was always like Christian music, right? We never listened to secular music. Puts music on. And then it brought me back to how I felt in childhood, that shame, that fear, that lot of sadness. And then I told him that when I was a kid, I used to lie down in bed, and we had a bunk bed, and I would be on the top bunk. And I remember looking at the ceiling, little popcorn ceiling, and I remember seeing smoke coming out of the ceiling. And I would tell my mom that, and I was like, there's smoke coming out of the ceiling. And I would like frantically like be upset. I was so anxious going to bed. And I'm looking at like thinking about that now, it's like I was either in like some sort of psychosis or hallucinating, or like I was really, really, I was certain that there was a fire in an attic that we didn't have. Like, you know what I mean? Like I was just, and I thought I was going to die in my sleep. And so now in my adult life, most recently, after I left a job that was really harmful and toxic for me, I realized that I went back into that frame of mind where I was like, I'm going to die. Like I had like a complete breakdown where I was like, I'm going to die. And the same kinds of feelings of like, am I going to die alone? Is there smoke coming out of the ceiling? Like all of those things. It was like, I felt like whatever was coming for me was like coming for me. Like I did something wrong to deserve this feeling, or like there was nothing that could save me. And it was it's that hopelessness. Like the terror is so connected to hopelessness because you're like, there's nothing that I can do. I can't escape this. Right. That was long. Yes. Sorry.
Okay. No, I'm so glad you talked about that because it's serendipitous that as I was processing these feelings in myself, I happened to, on a seemingly unrelated note, I happened to start reading this book called Legacy, Trauma, Story, and Indigenous Healing by Suzanne Mathot. And it really explained so much of my experience to me. Now, the book, the context of the book is exploring intergenerational trauma and how that affects her and her communities as an Indigenous person, the ways that genocide has created this legacy of trauma in Indigenous communities on the lands that we're currently on. And so I just want to say, so this is a real spoiler, not next episode, but the one after, we'll talk about intergenerational trauma and really get into the specific context of this book, because I think it's really important for us to examine it all in its context and, you know, our experiences of intergenerational trauma, but also how then we are a part of others' experience of intergenerational trauma. Right. So I just wanted to preface that we will explore the book in its fullness in a future episode. But I wanted to share a couple of quotes that really explained my life to me. So she says, "Unresolved trauma leads to chronic anger and chronic depression. And although the two emotions are on opposite ends of a spectrum, they are actually related. Anger helps people regain control or feel as if they are in control. However, fear of retribution means that Indigenous people who experience chronic trauma cannot express their anger toward their abuser. As a result, they internalize their anger. Eventually, it becomes what Judith Lewis Herman, who's a feminist psychiatrist, calls a malignant self-hatred that morphs into chronic depression, self-destructive behavior, and suicidal ideation." And she goes on to say, "Survivors begin to expect that something bad will happen in the future, which prevents them from taking action in the present. When they do act, their internalized self-hatred, manifested through the cognitive and emotional processes by which the survivor attempts to make sense of their situation, they must be treating me this way because I deserve it, means they attribute any failure to personal causes, which results in self-blame. See, I did deserve it."
Okay, so what I'm hearing, I'm just trying to clarify, because that was, there was a lot there that is that is like so important to tease out. So anger, a lot of the times, is about wanting to regain some semblance of control.
Yeah, it's like wanting to protect ourselves, right? And like fight back against what's happening.
Right. And when you feel like you're not able to express your anger, when you feel like you're not able to protect yourself in that way, it turns inward.
Yeah. So I think what she's really getting to is that when we have experiences of trauma, when we're harmed in a way that is overwhelming, that's violating, all of these feelings come up. So she talks specifically about anger in this one, and that's a big one, and a big one that causes the self-hatred specifically. Fear is another one. Like, that's a very intense emotion that comes up with harm, with trauma. Grief is another one. Like, there's a lot of really big energies and emotions. And when we're not able to release those because we don't have the support to do so, or the resources, or it's not safe to do so. And I think that is really big here. So I think when we talk about the ways that, you know, you and I, the way that our parents maybe, or other adults in our lives, the ways that they harmed us, when you're talking about religion and the role that it played in your life, where it wasn't really something you could question, like, this is just what you have to believe, we can't express anger, right? You can't express anger towards the church when you're a child being raised in the church. Like, you can't vocalize or even probably understand the ways that it's harming you. Or when you're being, you know, emotionally or physically or sexually abused by parents or other adults, it's not safe to fight back, right? Like, you've talked about, you know, your experiences with your dad, and I had, you know, similar ones in a lot of ways of, like, they're releasing all of their anger or whatever feelings at you, but it'll just make it worse if you release any of your anger, any of your even fear or sadness a lot of the time. So we end up holding it all in our bodies. And yeah, I think specifically anger, it's such a, I don't know, it's such like a, it's an indictment in a way, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that there's something wrong.
Right.
And right. If it's not safe to acknowledge that that's with somebody else, the only option is ourselves.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yep. I follow. And I feel that a lot in relation to what I just said. Like, I felt like the church was so harmful. The things that I was being taught were so harmful, but I didn't have the space, like you said, to question it or speak back to it or whatever. So I just turned inward, and it was about me being imperfect, which everybody is.
Like, yeah. But yeah, it's like there's something going so wrong. And if it's not them, like everybody else seems to say that this is normal. Yeah. So I guess it has to be me. The problem is with me. Right. Why am I just not, you know, better? And so another person whose work I wanted to lean on in this episode is Bell Hooks. And she says, there is a voice inside that is constantly judging, first ourselves and then others. That voice enjoys the indulgence of an endless negative critique. Because we have learned to believe that negativity is more realistic, it appears more real than any positive voice.
Oh my God, I love that. I love that so much. I need you to send that exact quote to me after this episode. That sums up so much about, yes, dude. I don't know what to say. That gets me. It kind of ties back to the hopelessness thing. It seems, you seem like a fool to have hope. It seems dumb. It seems like, well, what's the point? It seems like we are so scared to imagine the possibilities because it seems like they're never even going to come true, that all we have is room to do and all that feels safe to do because we're trying to manage our expectations is to critique and to hold on to the negative. Does that make sense? Or do you know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. And I think that's a lot of us, we grow up in environments that are very critical. And then, you know, the world, our culture is very negative in a lot of ways. And so I think we grow to believe that that's what's normal. And, you know, on a bigger scale, I think a lot of these feelings, it's like the ways that we've been taught that we deserve to be abused and we deserve to be harmed. And those experiences have been so powerful in shaping us that they feel true at such a deep level that when we try to give ourselves love or we try to accept love from others, that doesn't fit with like our oldest ideas of what we deserve and what the world is.
Right.
And so that doesn't feel real to us.
Right. Right. And if it's not real for us, then it can't be real for other people. And then I think that ends up, wow.
And so then I think another, a complementary concept to understand, you know, for me, like, how these feelings seem to come out of nowhere and just sort of overwhelm me. It's the idea of an emotional flashback. So with trauma, one of the effects of it can be having flashbacks to the traumatic event. And I think a lot of people have heard of that when it comes to PTSD, but I think often people imagine it like, you know, if you see like a movie about like a war veteran and they like suddenly have like the images of war, like like on the screen flashing, it's as if they're like completely reliving it. And I think so often people don't recognize flashbacks in themselves if it doesn't feel like a movie playing on a screen in front of their eyes. And specifically with chronic or complex trauma where it wasn't one event or one, you know, really isolated
incident
context, right. Yeah, where they experience the trauma, it's more pervasive, like with being abused as a child or neglected as a child, intergenerational trauma as well. Often it doesn't come back to one memory and we might not even have like any kind of visual or conscious awareness of like specifically what we're flashing back to, but the emotions from the trauma come back. And so that is why you can, you know, for me, like I can seemingly be living this like happy in many ways, like having done so much healing work and feeling so good about myself. And then suddenly there is some kind of trigger that might be so small that I don't even realize it's happening. It might be a color or, you know,
a smell,
or it could be anything. Mm-hmm. And suddenly like my system is back to being 6 years old or 10 years old or 19 years old or whatever it is when the really bad things that cause this like terror or this shame or this feeling that, you know, I've done something horrible, which is my, you know, at the time way of understanding why I'm being treated this way. It's suddenly real again.
Mm. I'm really grateful that you mentioned that often the pervasive kinds of traumas might not be linked to like one specific incident, because I think a lot of the times if we don't have that one incident, you know, I can think about an incident like, you know, the sexual violence I experienced, like my sexual assault, is like, that's an incident that I can, that feels like neat and tidy, that I can be like, that is a source of a lot of harm. And I know what that's about. But a lot of like childhood upbringing feelings that you had, like those things are so like sneaky. It's so much harder to articulate to somebody. Like it has been hard to articulate to my dad, like, this is how you made me feel. And he was like, well, how? I don't understand it. And next episode, spoiler alert, we'll talk about healing relationships with family, which I think will like go nicely into the next one about intergenerational trauma. We're on a fucking vibe. Mm. Listen to us. But
I'm gonna send you that NSYNC
gift. I know, NSYNC for real. But anyways, yeah, thank you for that, because I think a lot of us will spend energy being like, well, if I don't have the incident in mind, then do I deserve to feel this way? Or like, can I even feel this way? And it's like, yeah. If the culture and the dynamics and like the air that you were breathing was traumatic, that's kind of hard to boil down into like one single image in your mind, you know?
Yeah. And thank you for saying it like that, because I think that is a feeling that comes up so often for those of us who experienced neglect or abuse or other forms of chronic trauma, is the feeling of not deserving to have our feelings, or not being able to give ourselves the space to feel everything that we feel because we weren't given that space. Mm. So this leads into talking about how we heal and build a relationship with ourselves. And the biggest thing for me, it's caring for ourselves. So bell hooks says, we are not born knowing how to love anyone, either ourselves or somebody else. However, we are born able to respond to care.
Wow. When I hear that, it sounds like letting yourself indulge in the care that others are giving you. Because like a lot of the times that's hard. As you were talking about, and both of us have experienced that, like, oh, y'all like me? Like, you want to be my friend? It's kind of like there's a part of you that's rejecting, you know, there's a part of you that's resisting and rejecting people's love for you. Letting yourself be loved is a trip. I'm just saying.
And it can be really scary for people who haven't experienced love and care as safe. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of people who experienced love and care from the same people we've experienced abuse and neglect from. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. It doesn't feel safe to completely open ourselves up. But we are able to have new experiences, as scary as that can be, and responding to the care from others, but also caring for ourselves. Like, I think we can really respond to care from ourselves as well. And I think often our relationship with ourselves, you know, I think it's not only the most important, but the most complicated one. Because really, I mean, the more intimacy you have, the more complicated and difficult it gets. And there's nobody we have more intimacy with than ourselves, right? Like, yeah. Being inside our own minds and being aware of, you know, all of the things we're aware of from, you know, the inside of our bodies, the inside of our minds, it's so hard. And I think we often neglect, bell hooks always talks about how love is a verb, love is a thing that you do. Yeah. And we often neglect, like, the fact that that's for us too. Like, we also have to act out
love for ourselves,
care for ourselves, yeah. Love for ourselves. Yeah.
Wow.
I think that's something you do, right, with the self-compassion practice that you have, of seeing that part of you that's young and that's hurting and just really letting yourself feel love and compassion for her.
You know what I've realized? The parts of myself that weren't able to express who I was when I was younger only through like music and songwriting, those parts of me still exist within me. And I've recognized that a lot of the times when I have that internal self-hatred pop up, I can go back to what I know to be true, which is that my pen and writing affirms me. So yesterday I was like, I don't know, I was in a spiral because a girl has been trying to build a business. I am working for myself, and I'm speaking that out into existence so that people can hold me accountable on a podcast. And that comes with a lot of having to fucking manage your own personal internal scripts and shit and whatever. And so yesterday I like wrote down like, you have good ideas, you know, the things on your heart are worth expressing to other people. Like I wrote that down because I know that if I don't write it down and I just think it as a fleeting thought and that's helpful in the moment, I'm going to forget it and I'm not going to know how to come back to that. So I need to write it down somewhere so that I can read, you know, I'll read it today, I'll read it tomorrow, and I'll come back to like, okay, yeah, that's true. Like that's, my self-compassion is so tied to like the ways in which I felt I couldn't express my, it's like I'm expressing myself. It's weird. It's cyclical. It's like I'm expressing myself through writing, and a lot of what I'm scared of is expressing myself. So I'm writing. Like it's like sometimes it comes back to that weird, like the more you do that thing that you are scared to do, the more it becomes like a muscle memory where you're like, no, this is the path. Like the thing that I'm scared to do is because it feels like I'm activated through it. So like, let me work through that activation and write it down, write it into existence, speak it into existence.
There is something really powerful and magical about that practice because we can think thoughts inside of our own head, but I think being able to get them out in some way that's concrete, I feel like, you know, material, I think that that's really powerful in a different way, you know, the same way that like hearing somebody else say those words to you is going to be more powerful than like you just thinking them. Yes. And it's like a way of almost saying it to yourself out loud. Yes.
Absolutely.
And I think too, you know, I would just want to like encourage all of us and, you know, no one more than myself to expand, you know, these self-compassion practices. Like we talk a lot about inner child work, you know, having compassion for younger us, but I feel like we need to practice that exact same way of holding ourselves as, you know, as precious and innocent and deserving of love and care as our child selves or as another child, you know, mm-hmm. We have to practice that all the time. Like I need to learn to give myself that compassion and care, you know, not just 6-year-old me, but also 19-year-old me and also me of this moment and me of tomorrow and yesterday, you know.
Yes. I love that.
Which is a lot harder.
Yeah. You know what? That's true. Because the past is like, you already know that you've been through it. So you're able to be like, the past is somewhat controlled, but like the future you're like, I know I'm going to fuck up. Like I know that I'm not like always going to be exactly who I want to be showing up in the world, but like, I'm still deserving of love and care.
Yeah. And you know, I think belonging, a feeling of belonging is also so healing. And so I think the more that we can share with each other, connect with each other, and connect to the world and nature and all of those things, I think gives us more of a feeling of wholeness. So another excerpt from Suzanne Methot's book, Legacy, she says, well, and this is so interesting. So she talks about how healing practices from various indigenous cultures from other parts of the world as well, there's a lot of overlap in them. So she talks about specifically her experience getting healing from Chinese medicine. And so she says, in traditional Chinese medicine, the spleen carries the qi of the earth or the life energy. Selena, her practitioner, says, I need to get out of my head and spend more time connecting to the natural world. So I start doing healing practices outside, on the grass, in my bare feet. After I finish, I lie down on the earth with my arms spread out wide. One day, as Selena is treating yet another sacrum alignment issue, she gets to the heart of the matter. She takes her fingers away from my wrist, where she has been feeling my pulses, looks at me, and says, you have a right to be here, you know. Selena's words help me understand my worth. I am part of creation, connected to the wind that whips up from Scanadario, the handsome lake in the language of the Haudenosaunee, also known as Lake Ontario, the trees outside my window, the hawks that hunt pigeons in the parking lot up the street, and the water that flows underground, feeding the Humber River watershed. I am part of the web of creation. If the natural world is sacred, then that makes me sacred. I'm not nothing and no one. I have a right to be here.